Circus Feminist International Radio Endeavor. I'm very pleasure to be here with Lynn Francis. Lynn, please introduce yourself.
My name is Lynn Francis. I live and work in Zimbabwe, which is in Southern Africa. And I'm the International Steering Committee for Sub-Saharan Africa for the international community of women living with HIV. I also run a program in my own country called The Center, which is a treatment, care, advocacy, lobbying, training run by and for people living with HIV.
How is the situation in terms of the women in Zimbabwe living with HIV?
Well, we have multiple stresses. Zimbabwe is currently in a state of conflict. It's not a war, but it's a political conflict. We have internally displaced people, and the majority of the people in the camps are women and children. The men tend to be able to get out and go elsewhere. There's millions of Zimbabweans in the diaspora. So that also affects the lives of women living with HIV. Because of our international political pariah state, there is almost no aid coming in for HIV and AIDS to Zimbabwe. So again, the access to treatment, care, support is very, very limited. And we still have cultural barriers for women, which are the same in the whole of the Southern African region. There are a lot of things that mitigate against women's sexual and reproductive health.
I'm very interested in one thing you said before in your panel presentation. You said we, as HIV positive persons, we have the right to have sex, we have the right to the pleasure, we have many rights. Please talk more about that.
Well, I think, you know, the perception of HIV as a sexually transmitted disease and the linkage between HIV and immorality, promiscuity, somehow in many African countries, it's still perceived as a punishment from God for immoral behavior. Coupled with that is the fact that women's status is very, very poor. And that the whole discussion around sex and sexuality, and you mentioned the word pleasure, that is a taboo. We don't discuss those things. There used to be mechanisms whereby young people, when they reached adolescence, they went to be taught about those things to the aunties and to the uncles. Now, because of the breakdown of the extended family, that is not happening. But still, parents find themselves unable to talk about sex and sexuality to their children. So within that whole concept, just the concept of women's sexuality, of women having rights to a sexual life, of women having choices around their sexual and reproductive health, those are already very, very hard. Now you add HIV serostatus into that, and suddenly it's not just hard, it's impossible. When I started talking back in 1991 publicly about my positive status, and I said, you know, my husband has died of HIV, but sooner or later I want to have a lover. I was like, shock, horror, how could you say such a thing? I got hate calls and so on. Because now, not only was I a woman, how could I be making such a statement? But I was HIV positive, therefore sex for me was closed. This was a closed door. And still the tools for having sex, having pleasure, and being protected and protecting others are not in the hands of women, and particularly not in the hands of HIV-positive women. If I go to a family planning clinic or a place where they do, you know, sexual and reproductive health. And I say I'm an HIV positive woman. They send me across to the HIV clinic. They don't think that this is my place to be here asking about antenatal care, asking about in vitro fertilization, asking about contraception. The counseling is abstinence is your best tool now.
We, as a feminist, say that we don't have the power in our bodies. Seems like this conference and a lot of discussions about HIV are related with doctors or medicals or those things, and we don't hear many things about human rights. So for you, what is the strategy we have to use to let our voices be heard about that?
I think one of the biggest problems that we as women with HIV have faced was that in the early days of the epidemic, the women's movement, the feminist movement, did not take ownership of positive women. There was a them and us divide. And it's taken quite a long time for the women's movement, the gender, the feminists, to own HIV-positive women as part of them. And then also you have the vast majority of women in the most affected areas don't have any education about what rights are. They don't know that they have any sexual rights. In my country, for instance, in customary law, a woman remains a minor till she dies. She is initially under the guardianship and custody of her father, then she's handed over to the guardianship and custody of her husband, and then if the husband dies, she's either inherited by his brother or she's under the guardianship and custody of her male child, who might be 2-3 years old. And there is very, very little collaboration between, for instance, the women parliamentarians in our countries and the rights of rural women who have HIV. Women are still struggling just to have a voice up in the government level. And then to do that, they in many ways have to compete with men. And they don't want to be seen as now associated with sex workers, with women who have been promiscuous, that whole area. So what I think we really need to do is to realize we are all women. Wherever we live, whatever our seropositive status, our social status, our educational status, our religion, we are all women and we are all facing many of the same embargoes against us having rights to our body, choices about our body, rights to our emotional life and how to choose. We still have women who are sold into marriage.
You are HIV positive since 20 years.
22.
There is a taboo around that, the thing, the issue that you will die in 3 or 5 years. How would you do that? How to destroy this taboo?
Well, I think by being myself and being open and being public about the fact that, you know, I was diagnosed in 1986. I was told I had 3 to 5 years to live. By 1991, I was still healthy and strong. I wanted to see my grandchildren. And I realized that maybe being HIV positive was a mission that had been given to me. A gift, if you like. A purpose in life. That there were so many other women that didn't have some of the privileges I had. And that I needed to let them know that HIV is not a death sentence, that HIV is not the end of your life, that you can live in harmony with this virus. And I should emphasize that I don't take antiretroviral therapy either. So I teach people long-term survival techniques, how to live positively, using the holistic management of disease and of life. I think one of the problems that we have is the two approaches to living positively. The one is the medical approach. You know, you have to get onto these drugs. If you get onto these drugs, you can prolong your life. And the other is the behavior change approach. And, you know, you have to change your behavior. You now have to adopt other sort of strategies. But they're only talking about sexual behavior. They're not talking about health-seeking behavior. They're not talking about how do you encompass HIV within the broad spectrum of what it is to be a woman, to be living positively with this virus. So that is what I set out to change. Now I have 10 3/4 grandchildren. Something I thought that would be impossible when I was first diagnosed.
Sure. And what is this holistic approach you mentioned?
Well, HIV is a disease that is not purely medical, because of stigma, because of its connection with sexual activity. It affects every area of your life. So it affects you socially, in your relationships with family. It affects you spiritually, in your relationships with God and the church. For a long time, the church was a barrier to women or people who wanted to live openly with HIV, because the church was judgmental. And so the spiritual aspect of support got cut away. The social aspect, the family often rejected, or you yourself rejected disclosure because you were afraid of rejection. You were afraid that your family would not understand, so you rejected yourself. It affects your working life, it affects your life, your economic life, your ability to produce, your ability to earn a livelihood. Stigma still plays a part in the workplace. And then it affects your physical, obviously, in terms of your overall well-being and health. And there is so little education around what it means to address all those factors, and the big one, which is nutrition. Nutrition is the most vital part of living positively. People don't talk about it. In fact, when you talk about multivitamins, healthy eating, a healthy lifestyle, there's a kind of, we've got the ARVs now. We don't need to do all that stuff. But the majority of people with HIV in Africa do not have the ARVs. And they are made to feel that if I can't get these ARVs because I'm poor, I'm going to die. And yet there are so many other things you can do, so many alternatives that can prolong the time when you may or may not need to be on ARVs, that can keep your quality of life and your health perfect indefinitely. And nobody's talking loudly enough about those. So that's really what I do. And I really practice what I teach. So I do those things. I ensure that I get support in all those four areas. I eat healthily. I take herbs. I use herbal medicine and multivitamin supplements. I monitor my health. I listen to my body. And I respond very quickly if my body is sending me messages. And one day I may need to go on the ARVs, who knows? But at the moment I don't need to.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.